All right, welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Kenningson. We're streaming out live on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also 21stCenturyWire.com. And just a reminder, this is a live broadcast, so if you're just joining us midstream, welcome to the program, but you'll also be able to catch the full show up on the podcasting platform shortly after the program. We'll be up at all the major venues, including Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, podcast news, wherever you subscribe to, will probably be there. So you can always get the download there. Also at 21st Century Wire, of course, and at alternatecurrentradio.com. If you follow ACR's website, there's a link to that on the show page at the top. Now, we're going to pivot to Europe right now. And a lot of people might be aware, some might not be aware. We did cover this on Friday on the UK Column News about this new piece of legislation under the guise of fighting online hate or battling hate speech, various forms that the government has framed this in the Republic of Ireland, in the EU. And this is a unique piece of what we're calling authoritarian legislation because it more or less eviscerates some basic civil liberties, like the right to privacy, what information or memes or documents you have on your devices, whether they be a smartphone or a laptop or something like this. This new legislation gives the police in Ireland the power to seize your device and look for what they call potentially hateful content or that you might be spreading online or putting in public that may harm or upset somebody. It's very difficult to really narrow down because it's so arbitrary. It is so vague. But then the most authoritarian pieces of legislation by authoritarian states tend to be arbitrary, and that's the whole point of it. But this is shocking nonetheless, and so we want to talk to somebody. We're hoping to get some really good insight on this. He is a journalist and writer, political commentator. He's been on the program before. His name is John Waters, and he is in Ireland, and there's a link to John's Substack on our show page. I really encourage people to click through, follow, and subscribe to John's Substack. Great writing, great insights. We've covered some important issues in the past. We're going to bring him on the line right now, live from Ireland. Hello, John. How you doing?
Hello, Patrick. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. This is just kind of an extraordinary situation, John, because the last time we spoke was kind of at the height of the COVID hysteria in your country. And your country was one of the last and one of the most strict in terms of all the restrictions. They held out to the very end before lifting all these restrictions. And I felt like a breath of fresh air after that. I could go and travel there or see friends. And then all of a sudden this happens. But this is actually just a symptom of, I think, a much bigger problem in your country. Firstly, welcome to the show, John. And what do you think about this latest situation? Tell us how this has unfolded.
Well, I mean, back in 2020, you know, when all this COVID pandemic stuff started, I mean, some of us instinctively realized there was something not quite right about it, to say the least. But we did resist it, and we took legal actions and began to write, began to speak about it, and so on. But you know, at that time they had the cover of the concept of emergency, and it was kind of, in some respects, culturally quite difficult to combat that because they had brainwashed the population and propagandized every corner of the island. And but now this is like, oh boy, this is something new. Yeah, this is something like beyond even that. I mean, but it's clearly a continuation and escalation of that. To those who have been watching this, and we did expect something like this. We did expect an escalation. But even those of us who expected it are utterly gobsmacked by what we're seeing here, because this is like the end of a civilization. You know, it's like this is like an invading army coming into your country. This isn't any more like the behavior of your own government. You know, I look at these guys now and say, "Who are you? Who actually are you? You've been here. These guys have been here in our country. You know, in our political system, many of them like for 20 years, maybe more." And we thought we had the measure of them. We thought they were of us. We thought that they spoke a good line and liberalism and freedom and democracy and all these things. And now they're absolute tyrants. And they're not ashamed of it. This is the shocking thing. I mean, this law, I mean, you give a pretty good summary of it. There are other aspects of it which are just as dire. I mean, it essentially inverts the presumption of innocence, for example. You have to prove, once you are accused under this law, you have to prove that the accusation is false. They don't have to prove that it's true. I mean, they can say that you, they can send the police into your house to seize your computer, right? And if they find on that computer a draft article, for example, or I don't know, it's something that, that you had intended to publish, which is hateful. Now, that could be anything, Patrick. I mean, it could be a book or an article by somebody like Douglas Murray, not wishing to government any bother, but, you know, who has written widely on the subject of mass migration in Europe for the last 5-6 years. And you might have that article, and you might intend, you might have to maybe extract a few quotes from it. I don't know what criteria they will apply. But once they actually find that there, you then have to prove that you did not intend to publish it. Once it's established, once they decide that it's hateful in some way, and that the definitions of hate are not, there are no definitions, by the way, of hate. I mean, the definition of hate in this legislation reads something like, hatred is hatred of X, Y, and Z, different categories, what are called protected characteristics, which in other words means, you know, black people, gays, you know, the usual culture Marxist listed victims, really. And any of those that you offend, you know, can make a case, or somebody can make a case on their behalf, you know. And this ultimately, therefore, Patrick, what it amounts to is a statute against the indigenous population, what you might call the normative population, the people who are not entitled to claim victimhood under any of these lists, any of these headings. And it is basically to say to the Irish people in general, particularly in the mass migration context, you no longer have any entitlements of proprietorship, ownership, or claim of what you call your country. You are now a second-class citizen, because these people have exalted rights to have you prosecuted, to intimidate you, to threaten you, to warn you, if you even look at them crooked, be careful, mister, because I can put you in jail.
And so that's quite insidious, because you have all these advocacy NGOs now. You've probably seen them. You can probably rattle off a few of them in your country, but here you have them in the UK, and then you have all these anti-hate NGOs, Hope Not Hate, all these charities, registered charities, foundation-funded, Soros-funded. So an advocate could step up and, you know, maybe accuse you or dox you or shop you to the authorities, saying, well, look, he's been tweeting this or saying this on Facebook, and we think that he's harboring dangerous material on his devices. Maybe,
Well, for example, I my Substack platform, JohnWaters.substack.com, I've already written over the last 2 years several articles about this bill, criticizing it in pretty, you know, strong terms, shall we say. I'm not holding back, because it is a deeply insidious piece of legislation. I have no intention of taking those off my Substack site. And as soon as this law becomes, once the president signs it, then there is no question that this creep in that we now call our president, or they call our president, I don't call him my president, because of what he's done in relation to, you know, the vaccination things and so on. Quite shocking stuff. Apartheid, essentially. Medical apartheid. He signed it into law without even a question. This is a liberal, you know. So somebody can then say, well, these articles are on there, on his Substack. I could get a visit from the police. They can take my computer, Patrick, you know, and they don't have to give me a time limit. They don't have to say, well, we'll have it back to you in a month or a year. They just take it. They can hold on to it indefinitely. So that's my livelihood gone. I have to then find another 1,200 quid or whatever it is to buy another laptop, and they can take that the next day. You see what I mean? So there's all of this aspect as well. This is really not low at all, Patrick. It's very important to stress this. It's what's called lawfare, which is really a kind of such a loose formulation of legalities and definitions that it could mean anything. And therefore, that what actually, the way it works is that it intimidates by being so broad that everybody becomes, theoretically anyway, becomes intimidated to the point that they leave certain subjects alone. And the point about it is that in a certain sense, they don't even need to take you to court because the process is enough to silence you. Once you're fingered, once you're visited, then you have great difficulty in continuing because you know you will be on a list and they will just come around again and take your devices again. And that's, therefore, it's the chilling factor that is even more insidious than what's written down in the legislation. I mean, some of the stuff in it, Patrick, is beyond belief. You know, like there's talk about, for example, that it's not just your words that will be taken into account in the court, but your behavior. And I want to just read you a paragraph here, a very short paragraph.
No, please, please do.
For the purpose of this part, a person's behavior shall include behavior of any kind, and in particular, things that the person says or otherwise communicates, as well as things that the person does. And such behavior may consist of a single act or a course of conduct. Now, what's that? That could be like a smirk. It could be like an upturned nose. It could be a kind of, you know, a grin. Who knows? And you see, the point about it is that it is essentially something, because the measure of this shall be essentially the most paranoid person in the vicinity or the most ideologically minded person in the vicinity. They will have the ability and the capacity to drag you before the courts, and you may end up before a judge with equally or more ideological, and that will be the character, because he can interpret or she can interpret the legislation in whatever way he or she, it is entirely subjective and is grotesquely prone to arbitrariness. So essentially it is a totalitarian instrument in the precise and ultimate meaning of that term. It is total in its attempt to close down not just the speech, but actually the thought. It's trying to turn off thought at source so that it doesn't even get to the root of the tongue. That it's total. And this is like, you know, again, I want to just go back really to my shock. I mean, we have in the last 2 years, Patrick, I mean, I've often said this a million times, I've said how almost impossible it is to articulate what is happening. The feelings that it brings up in one, you know, because you're constantly kind of going back and forth in one's mind about, you know, people who are doing this and the things they said in the past and how they seem to be normal democratic politicians and how they spoke about freedom and liberalism, like the president. Like, I mean, he was like never stopped pontificating about all of these values, and now he shreds them. Every time the bill is put in front of him, he just signs it. And he himself admitted that he actually apparently signs them without reading them. Because the last time we raised this, back in July of 2021, when he signed essentially COVID apartheid, a vaccine apartheid into law, and there was quite a backlash from the resistance. And he complained afterwards that he was getting too many bills to sign and was overworked. The implication, obviously, being that he hadn't time to read them, and this is like the level we have reached. But it's very important, I think, Patrick, as well, to note that, because sometimes we can look into this in a narrow focus. This is occupation, and it isn't. Whereas I say that these people who are doing this are our own elected representatives, and they are behaving in the most extraordinarily bizarre and unprecedented manner, and in no way seeking to exculpate them. They are not the architects of this. This has been globally orchestrated. And it will actually, this is a test, this is a kind of a Petri dish experiment in Ireland, as we've had of many of them in the last decade under different headings. And they will be pushing this all out all over Europe and America and Canada and Australia and so on. But we are here in this situation, and we are looking absolutely open-mouthed at this. And
But we because the discussion and the media is so corrupt, nobody in Ireland knows anything about this, really. They don't even know. I was speaking to a bunch of lawyers. I was in a room with about five lawyers the other day, and I started to talk about it. None of them knew it was happening. This is the shocking thing. You know, like, I find it really impossible to explain to people outside of Ireland how bad things are here, because people have this notion of Ireland, you know, that we're somehow, we're an island, we're cut off from the world, and we have our own culture, blah, blah. We don't. We don't. We are completely occupied by woke, for a start. But woke is just an instrument. This is a proxy war. Woke is the instrument where these useful idiots, the LGBT people, the race people, all of these, the NGOs, as you say, we have 35,000 NGOs, actually, Patrick, in Ireland. I'm not joking. And they cost us $6 billion per year.
Wow.
$6 billion. That's a hell of a lot of money. That doesn't sound a lot in British or American terms. But for us, that's about kind of half our, you know, that's the expenditure on our health service, for example, something like that. You know, this is an occupation, and it's part of the global occupation of the World Economic Forum and all of this stuff that we've talked about in other contexts. But it's the most hurtful and really despair-making aspect of it is that it is being blindly implemented by people we thought of as, if not our friends, our representatives, our delegates, the people nominated, trusted to run our country and protect it and protect our children and protect our freedom and protect the heritage and birthright of our children into the future. And they are selling it down the river and punching in the face anybody who tries to speak about it. And that's essentially what this is about. It's to prevent any further discussion of what they're doing until they've finished.
Now, this is clearly, as you said, lawfare is a good term. That's something people can process crimes. This is the people we can relate to this. But really what it is state intimidation. It's harassment. And to me, this really shows a state, a power structure that's very insecure about its mandate, about what it's doing. And they tend to double. This is what authoritarian regimes do throughout history. They double down because they're increasingly insecure. It's like a self-replicating phenomenon. And what you just described with the details of this bill, how someone behaves or signals they may be giving off that are, this is like basically a Stasi dossier. Because you remember watching all these cinema noir films about life behind the Iron Curtain or dramas or documentaries, and that's exactly what they paper the file with, all sorts of observations, and would criminalize and demonize somebody and deem them to be mentally ill or whatever. And that's what the secret police did, or the NKVD or the Stasi.
That's right. And it is directed at the indigenous population. You see, like, to say the indigenous population, it's a phrase we are used more and more nowadays. We obviously never used this growing up in this country. Never used it until the last couple of years. You didn't have to. There was an indigenous population of Ireland, and that was they were the Irish. But in the last few years, they've actually, behind the backs of the people, have imported. You see, we didn't have any the conditions for culture and Marxism at all, but they imported them. They imported an oppressed class, self-styled, fake, you know, with fake refugees and so on. And now they're leveraging those in order to suppress the indigenous population and silence that. And what you have here, that fundamentally in this law, Patrick, is the end of equality before the law, as I was saying. You know, that the native now is at a disadvantage because he is a quasi-criminal even before he opens his mouth or behaves in any way. Implicitly, he's potentially a target of an accusation of some kind of suspicion. In a way that the newcomer isn't, or the other category, that even say the gay person is actually, who is a beneficiary of these in these protected characteristics in one context, is at risk in another context from the migrant, because they haven't actually put migrant status into this bill yet, but they have said now they intend to add it as an amendment. Of course, they always intended to do that. That's one of the primary things, because they are using this mass migration. I mean, we've had it now. like for 20 years, we've had fairly sustained and uncheckable migration, inward migration, starting back at the opening up of the European Union back in 2004. And then it became more and more extra European Union. And in the last 3 years particularly, they've been just bringing in like hundreds of thousands of migrants by step, really, at dead of night, while the country was locked down in particular. So this is like a deliberate strategy. It is a recolonization. It is a replantation. And that's the kind of thing that replantation, me saying that word out, that will be regarded as a hate crime. Because I'm not allowed to describe reality, because reality is so unfavorable to the scum who are doing this to us.
But the term protected characteristics, this is an unbelievable Swiss Army knife to stick in a piece of legislation. I mean, so for instance, like the trans lobby or the trans population is 0.01% or something. But if you had a meme on your phone or a joke or had tweeted something or writing an article on this, that's a protected characteristic. It's not a race. It's not a religious group. So they've expanded the dragnet, as it were, for you can't really have. It's a Swiss Army knife in that today it's trans. Tomorrow it could be something else. They can just add and subtract from the list of protected characteristics.
Yes, and it's also very important, and again, we've touched on this already, but just to emphasize this, that all of these protected characteristics have, in a sense, standing armies. Whether it's the NGOs or the LGBT goons on the street or, you know, the BLM.
Antifa. Yeah.
So that they're ready to go into the attack. You see, that's another aspect of it, like that. It's something that will happen to a high degree between the people themselves, or at least not between the authorities and the people, visibly or overtly, for the most part. It'll be like COVID in that sense, where the people will be persecuting each other and policing each other, watching each other, spying. Again, you said about the Stasi. That's the whole point, that people will watch you. And, you know, I mean, even, you know, your own, you know, even to have a dinner party in your own home with people you don't intimately know and inside out would be quite a risky thing if you were to say something untoward or potentially interpretable as untoward. This could be reported, and this person could stand as a witness against you, and you could be convicted on that, living in your own house. You know, it's the end of privacy, and that's a very important thing about this pathogen, that it's, you know, privacy is, the state hates privacy, because while you have privacy in a culture, in a nation, in a country, people have autonomy, and they have a basis for their sovereignty to go into their shell, to go into their, cross their threshold, close the door, and then to think, to you know, consider, to read, to study, and then to answer, to confront the state if it is misbehaving in any way. This will put an end to that. I mean, this has been an element of the COVID, the pandemic measures, the lockdown measures from the start. When you look at them, so many of the mechanisms were about isolating people and preventing social intercourse and prevent people meeting in informal ways. Even symbolically, when you used to see, remember that thing I used to see it all the time. It's just hilarious at one level, but really dismal at another, where you would see a group of people in the park, and they would be standing 6 foot apart in a circle, grown adults, you know, on a sunny day, you know, standing 6 foot apart, shouting to each other across this empty space. Like, that is the greatest, I think, symbol of totalitarianism that we've seen in our free countries for a long, long, forever. But this is now what it means. This is the meaning of it. Like, you know, you see, this is the thing I cannot get my head around. This is slightly off the point, but it's one of the things that I wrestle with every day. It's like, how did we come into this situation? Like, how we knew all about totalitarianism. We heard, we read our Orwell. We read our Solzhenitsyn. We knew about the Soviet Union. We knew about Nazi Germany. We knew about all of this. And it's like we've forgotten it all. I mean, the Irish Times, my former newspaper, Patrick, is writing articles, publishing articles, cheering the government to the echo for bringing in this
seizure, this confiscation of freedom of speech. The Irish Times, the leading newspaper of record in our nation for 170 years.
So that's your fourth estate, which is meant in a democracy or a democratic or republican form of government to hold power to account. That's, you cannot have a functioning a republican government, or you cannot have a functioning democracy without a fourth estate that plays that role. And if the if the fourth estate then is then defending the power of the state, then the whole thing is inverted at that point. And it doesn't, it's dysfunctional.
And when you then zoom in on how they justify this, you see, they justify it in this context exactly in the same model as they operated during the COVID thing, where they essentially created a kind of groupthink, culturally speaking. And a very critical part of the groupthink mentality is the creation of an outgroup, which galvanizes the in-group. So in order to galvanize the majority population to the idea that there was a deadly disease and that any kind of anybody not obeying the rules was a danger to public health, they had to then summon up this, anybody who questioned it in any way became, you know, far right or, you know, and so on. All these labels were trotted out. And the thing is that even though they're comical in the first instance, you hear them, and this is so ludicrous. There is no far right in Ireland. It never has been. Like, it's a nonsensical notion. I mean, what we have are a few raggle-taggle little parties and groups, you know, who are basically questioning the government in a very, you know, largely like, you know, myself, and in an amateurish way. We're not professional politicians or anything like that. And then you have, you know, in the last year in particular, a lot of protests about the imposition of dozens upon hundreds of migrants on tiny communities. You know what I mean? It's like they're not even consulted. They're not even told these people are coming. The next thing, the buses arrive. I was in a village up the country there a few weeks ago, and there was there's a population of the village is 122 people. And they were expecting within a couple of days a contingent of 144 foreigners to be imposed on their village. People they didn't know anything about, who were unchecked, unvetted. In a context where there is massive amounts of reports of crimes and rapes and sexual assaults and so on as a result of prior arrivals of migrants in various communities. And so this is the far right concept. This is where they get it. But they keep repeating it. And that has now been sufficient, Patrick, for them to demolish the entire edifice of their prior political beliefs. They were liberals. They believed in freedom. They believed in free speech. They believed in free assembly. They believed in the right of people to walk around their country unfettered by the police, and so on. Now they don't. This is all gone overnight. And it's quite shocking. I mean, obviously, like, this has to do with the purchased nature of the media now, and the fact that the mainstream media was in dire straits, and there's advantage was taken of that on a global basis by the so-called pandemic mechanism. But now we have a situation where they're now selling out their principles, not alone their principles, everybody's principles. These are the principles of Western civilization. And they're basically saying they're null and void now. In a matter of months after the first, you know, blow, the first cut, It's beyond belief. I struggle, Patrick. I mean, I try to speak about these things. I hope I'm conveying my sense of absolute shock and horror that I'm even having to say these things. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I mean, I live in this country all my life. I cannot believe that these things are happening now.
It puts a chill on. If it puts a chill on dissent, this is a big problem, because dissent culture is often downstream from dissent. Dissident literature, dissident poetry, dissident films, dissident books, dissident journalism. That this becomes the culture of a society, of a country, and a good a free society will allow a certain level of provocation in speech and discourse, because that's what it takes to shake the system enough for people to get out of their sort of calcified positions. when there's a time of crisis or peril in the society. And if you then chill that, you can have, I think it's terminal, actually, for society.
Well, that's right. I mean, you see, this is a very interesting thing, Patrick, because I've noticed this in Ireland over the last decade, that there was a gradual erosion of the idea of what, let's call it, I don't like the word tolerance in this context, but, you know, that the idea that free speech should be tolerated came under some scrutiny and criticism from people. Because people, the next thing you had, I heard groups saying, you know, that the LGBT group or the climate change group saying, well, you know, our argument is, well, is established now. We have public support and, you know, the science is in and blah, blah. So we shouldn't have to engage in public discussion about this anymore, you know. And it's a bit tiresome, like, that we have to engage in this democratic process. Discourse thing, you know, that was the general tone of things. And this has actually become a very prevalent idea now, particularly among younger people, but even in these group lawyers I was with the other day, and they were sort of half jokingly describing me as a contrarian. And I got into it. I said, well, okay, what do you mean by that? Like, contrary to what? Contrary to received opinion? Contrary to the majority opinion? You know, is that what you mean? And then I gave him a blast of John Stuart Mill and said, you know, that John Stuart Mill said that for a democracy to function, it needs something like this. That even if every single member of a population holds, apart from one, holds to a singular opinion, to one opinion, that society has a greater interest in listening to that one person who dissents than listening to the whole lot of the others. Because on that person may depend the future stability and safety and security of that democracy. Because if that person is right, then, as is possible, then the society will have been saved from great destruction, great damage. And if that person is wrong, the people who hold the majority view will be have been affirmed in the process of verification, in their opinion, and that would provide even greater stability and certainty into the future. None of these ideas are any longer understood in our former democracies. This is frightening to me, that people don't know what you're talking about, particularly young people. They say, well, you did say something offensive, as if that was the end of the matter. You know, the right to offend people should be sacrosanct. I mean, the funny thing about it is, Patrick, nobody ever minds about offending me. You know, I've never noticed anybody in democracy. You know what I mean? I find this remarkable. Like, you know, during the COVID thing, I couldn't walk down the street for guys on bicycles screaming obscenities at me because I'd taken a legal action against the government with a friend. And, you know, nobody kind of thought that was a hate crime at all.
Yeah, you didn't have protected characteristics, John.
No, I don't. I'm thinking of applying to have brown eyes maybe listed as a protected characteristic or something like that, because, you know, that's the only way we're going to get any kind of protection left in our country, remaining in our country. But this is the shocking. This has been prepared for a long time. I mean, we've had a series of referendums, which are essentially hammer blows delivered to the Constitution of Ireland in the past decade. And that was very much that thing I picked up all the time, that there was this sense of impatience on the part of the authorities, the government, you know, in certain elements in the press, all of them now, I guess, that, you know, what, do we have to go through this kind of tedious thing to get an abortion, which should be a basic human right? You know, well, yes, actually, you do, because this is in the Constitution, and it's a natural right. And you don't even have the right to take it out of the Constitution, actually. You can take it out, but it will not or should not nullify the right. But none of these ideas were permitted. And more and more you found that, you know, the kind of discussions that were being held on TV and radio, I must say, were kind of between, kind of, on certain issues. Like, they would be between religious viewpoints and secular viewpoints, rather than being between defenders of human rights and those who wanted to take them, or who wanted to create a different form of human rights, which is essentially done in relation to abortion in Ireland. Abortion, the right of the unborn child used to be as sacrosanct as the right of the living person. That's what natural law says. That's the inheritance we have. But now what the Constitution protects is the right to abortion.
A total inversion.
Yeah.
Incredible.
So it is incredible. I mean, but you see, the strange thing is, you see, that people are inveigled into joining these ideologies because they seem to think that they suit them. personally, maybe down the road, or because they like to be associated with a more kind of forward-looking, as they think, viewpoint. It never occurs to them to look at the possible consequences downstream. That once you, as it were, break the duck of a fundamental right, and that's happened numerous times in Ireland now in the last couple of decades, that there's no telling where it might end. Because, you know, the taking away the right of the unborn child could well end up as a precedent that makes involuntary euthanasia a possibility at some future point. You know, these are things, and you're not allowed to say these things. Because it's an amazing thing I found, that one of the kinds of things that I have been saying over the years in my contrary way, people think, they come true. They come true. And then people say, oh, well, that was obvious all along. You know, like, you know, it's mind-boggling, really, how these cultures are constructed. But I think most, as a former journalist, I call myself a former journalist, even though I still write in Substack. I say that because I'm so ashamed of the profession that I was a member of for 35 years. And I look askance at my former colleagues. I look at the gibberish they're writing. I weep for them, really. I'm shamed for them, you know, that they have so little self-respect that they're prepared to write the most appalling diatribes and nonsense. People who I respected greatly, you know, that I worked alongside, you know, and drank alongside and so on. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Because, you know, in many respects, Patrick, you know, I used to look up to these people and felt somewhat inadequate in the beginning, particularly because they were seen to be more enlightened, as it were, than I was, or, you know, more knowledgeable and more aware of historical drifts and trends and so on. And now it's like these things never happened. It's like all will never live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to play you a clip. You're probably familiar with this clip. It's from a recent press conference given by the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar. And they held a public consultation for this legislation. And I'm looking back at a poll by RTE, that's your national broadcaster, the BBC equivalent in Ireland. And this was in March of 2022, and when they polled the public about do they like this type of legislation, only 19% said yes. So that was 80% no, don't like it, 19% saying yes, roughly. And so that's a pretty definitive poll there. And then the vote in the lower house was 110 for, 14 against the legislation. So a total inversion of public opinion. And here's your Taoiseach. Listen to this clip and we'll discuss this. I find this to be one of the most extraordinary exchanges that I've seen in a long, long time. Here it is.
Taoiseach, your government conducted a public consultation regarding hate speech laws where citizens were asked to give their thoughts on the issue. And out of the thousands of responses from private individuals, over 70% were not supportive of such laws. And yet you're proceeding with them anyway. So my question is, why did your government bother to do a public consultation if you were just going to ignore the results?
Well, we do public consultations because we think they're good practice. It's a way to find out what people's thoughts are on issues. And it's also, you know, a way to flesh out and highlight some of the issues that we may not have considered. But we're also, you know, wise to the fact that the vast majority of people don't make submissions to public consultations. We have to bear that in mind. It's only a small portion of the population that participate in these things, so it's not necessarily reflective of public opinion. And also we're wise to the fact that very often submissions are organised and campaign groups will organise responses, so we're clear with that too.
But why hold the consultation if the end result is just going to be disregarded on the basis that it's not representative of public opinion? What's the point of it then?
Well, the point is that we're a democracy, and in Ireland we have elections, and decisions are made by the government and the elected parliament. They're not made on foot of public consultations or opinion polls. That's not what they're about. They're about testing the temperature.
So is it just for show then?
No.
Wow. John.
Yeah.
What do you...
Yeah, well, it's impossible to even answer that. I mean, it's impossible. You're just gobsmacked in the face of that series of self-contradictions in that tirade. You know, I mean, like, all of the referendums, for example, which were ran in the last decade, were preceded by gatherings called variously constitutional conventions and citizens' assemblies and so on, which were basically... number of people plucked from the electoral register, allegedly, and put into a room, which is essentially a group think chamber, and pummeled then for several weeks with propaganda from so-called experts on the particular question that the people, that the government wished to put to the people. This is not a democratic instrument, but their government is quite happy to use it in order to fashion public opinion. This guy is a complete liar, and he's a complete... This guy has no love of Ireland, Patrick. This is the most important thing. You know, he's half Indian, he's some Irish blood, but I would say a timberfolk. And he hates Ireland. Quite demonstrably, he hates Ireland. He hates the Irish people. He has shown this time and time again. He has complete contempt. You should see some of the speeches he made during the lockdown, you know, where he was quoting lines from... you know, movies, like, you know, as a kind of a taunt to the people. You know, there was an infamous episode back in May of 2020 when the country was locked down. Very sunny day, a Sunday, I think, or bank holiday weekend. And there was a ban on picnics. And he and his gay mates had a picnic in the Phoenix Park, the biggest park in Europe, in Dublin. And stripped to the waist, they were stroking each other's midriffs in full view of the public. like this, a kind of a sadomasochistic kind of thing, you know, a BDS, something like that. You know, it was almost as if that there was a power element to say, we can do what we like now. And this is essentially the meaning of all of this. That, you see, that what has happened, Patrick, is that democracy has been unplugged. Somebody just reached over at the skirting board and pulled out the plug, and democracy just went all out. But then immediately another plug was inserted on the far side of the room. And this plug is linked to the above, the supranational, to the WEF and the UN and the WHO and all these bodies. And they are the new electorate, as it were, of Ireland. So the people are complete new, they're an abomination, a contemptuous abomination. A nuisance, something that really, you know, is on its last chance, as it were, you know, from the guardians of our supposed democracy and our republic. This is the only way I can see it that seems to make sense to me, that, you know, they don't any longer, they have total contempt. It's hard to explain what they do. Like, they dump people from foreign countries, nobody knows where they are, in a little village, and they just tell people to shut up, just suck it up, make the best, just shut up. And they get their cronies, their purchase cronies in the media to do the same thing in their leaders and in their articles and their opinion pieces. And they let off these NGOs to, you know, attack anybody who tries to protect the communities and maybe more, you know, galvanize them to resist and so on. And then they're the far right. This is really quite shocking. But that is a fairly typical statement from Vladimir. That's the way he speaks about to the Irish people, and the reality is, Patrick, he has not really been elected. You know, he has been Taoiseach since 2017. He took over from Enda Kenny. You know, he was elected by his own party as their leader, and that made him Taoiseach. He lost the election of 2020. But he continued in office through the COVID period as a kind of a temporary government in the period of the early days of the lockdown, and he was the one who introduced all this stuff without any mandate whatsoever, all the lockdown stuff and everything. And he behaved contemptuously towards people, very similar to Trudeau in Canada or Macron in France. You know, I have a kind of a parlor game that I play in my head, which is like that. I you know, those three guys, you can have them in a room, and somebody with a blindfold goes in and touches one of them and says, "You go to Paris," touches another, "You go to Dublin," and the other, "You go to Ottawa." And then opens your eye, it takes off the blindfold and looks to see what the result is. And it really doesn't matter what the result is the point. It doesn't matter which of them goes to Dublin or Paris or Ottawa. They're indistinguishable. They're the instruments of the WEF and nothing else.
Yeah, Jacinda Ardern from New Zealand, I'd throw in that group as well.
Yeah.
She's another one. And Dan Andrews from the Victoria State in Australia. Yeah, it's very easy to see that sort of type of species, that political species. But what you said about NGOs reminds me John, of their stakeholders. So that 35,000 NGOs employ X amount of people. That's a whole constituency of stakeholders. That's the WEF's stakeholder democracy model for the future. Yes. Citizens assemblies, sortition, fake democracy. And they bring in their experts to brainwash the people. We've seen it. It's sold as a direct democracy, but it's total manipulation, and it's stakeholder democracy, and it's at the top are technocrats. So that's the new system.
It is, yes. I mean, essentially, that's exactly right. I mean, we've arrived in this at this moment where clearly, the way I see it is that, you know, that we were about to hit the cliff edge in economic terms, and something needed to be done, they thought, and that something needs to be done was not in a democratic imperative in any sense. It was an imperative to preserve the position, power, and wealth of those who already possessed those things. So it was a kind of a as the Spanish say, an auto culpe, a self coup, a global auto culpe, where they essentially moved in and commandeered the economies and nations of the world. And now we're at the point where they're about to unveil their solution, their remedy for all of this, which is essentially to render the human race, or the majority human race, obsolescent for all time, to reduce them to prisoners in 15-minute cities, high buildings, eating bugs and so on, and really keeping their mouths shut and just consuming. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that they attacked Ireland's indigenous population so viciously, was that that's a thing they do with all populations. Every country is different, slightly different in these things, and some there are some similarities. But in Ireland, you see, because we didn't have any culture Marxist material for them, they had to create it. And of course, what they wanted to do above all was to break the emotional connection between the Irish people and their country, to impress it upon them that that's now history. Forget about your heroes, forget about your patriot dead, forget about your sense of your country. It's not your country, it's his country and her country before you. The same as you, equal to you, they say first, and then say, and by the way, we're adding this hate speech law to actually make sure that they have a little bit of an edge over you in what you think is your country. Calling it your country will be hate crime in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've got a couple minutes left, and I know you've spoken about this, and you've written, you've done interviews on this subject, and I wanted to get your opinion of this radical transition of Ireland having swung into radical secularism, this radical progressivism, cultural Marxism, neo-Marxism, various ways that you could describe it. But how is this achieved? It is a really radical turn in a very short space of time. And what is the role, or what is not the role of the church in this process? And is that a fact? Has that been a factor in this massive reorientation?
Oh, I think so. I think so, Patrick. I mean, the church has been absolutely appalling. The church was appalling during the COVID episode. I mean, it basically went along with the state in every conceivable way. It treated its own people appallingly. But in other contexts, for example, in the context of mass migration, the church routinely misrepresents its own teaching in order to bully Irish people into accepting the unacceptable. I mean, anybody who knows anything remotely about Irish or Catholic teaching knows that, you know, the policy on relation to the theology on mass migration as laid down by Thomas Aquinas is nothing like what they're saying, open borders. Nothing like that at all. It's too detailed to go into now, but if people look it up, they'll be quite surprised, given the way the Pope speaks and the way the bishops speak and all about this, you know. So that's one of the things that they have basically been part of bullying the people. There was, I think, to answer your question more broadly, what happened? I think that essentially Ireland became too attractive. You see, when we were poor, I remember when I was young, you know, Ireland was poor. Nobody was interested. But then we kind of created this foreign direct investment model, and all the corporate with low tax rates, and all the corporations came here. Suddenly America particularly had an investment in Ireland and wanted to, was taking an interest in it and wanted to improve it, you know, in different ways and, you know, update its laws and make it more modern in its outlook and so on and so on. And essentially, I think that, you know, Ireland was subject to a coup. I've actually have a thesis that I've been exploring in this, and it broadly goes something like that. In 2011, just after, when the kind of fallout from the economic crash of 2008 was really culminating with the visitation of the Troika of the European Union, the European Commission, the IMF and the World Bank to basically seize Ireland's economic sovereignty in the in November 2010. And after that, there was kind of a coup in Ireland whereby we were taken over by the American deep state. And that they've been here since, and they've been managing. See, one thing I keep saying to people isn't, and isn't this true, that Irish politicians, in order to give them their due credit, are far too stupid to be able to do any of this stuff. You know, so somebody's obviously advising them. And you see, we've had these experiences in the last particular couple of years where something would happen. Like we've had a number of really grotesque murders by migrants. Right now, usually they're covered up when they can be. But in these couple of instances, what actually happened was something far more insidious and far more interesting, where there would be a sudden, like a psyop conducted in the public, with all the lot these bully boy Antifa, LGBT goons, and so on. For example, we had in Sligo, in the West, last year, two gay men were beheaded and castrated by a Muslim. And the version of this that was put out into the public arena, and still is remain, most people think this, was that this is something to do with Irish homophobia. The idea that it's a migrant and a Muslim is played down. And there's the president and everybody lectures Irish people about their homophobia. You see, under no circumstances, Patrick, could these guys have come up with that on their own. They wouldn't have dared. But they're being coached and instructed and encouraged by these people in the background. I won't mention the name of the organization, but there is a particular organization which is actually founded by an Irishman who does this kind of thing. And essentially it means organizing psyops and PR campaigns at the highest level or at the lowest level, if you prefer. So that's kind of where we are in this, that we are no longer Ireland. We are under occupation, invisibly. And these are all symptoms of that. Because nothing else explains it. Because that clip you played is really telling in that respect. It reflects, I think, what I say, that this guy who is supposed to be the leader of the Irish government doesn't give two figs for the Irish people. He's laughing at them. He's sneering at them, saying, "Well, yeah, we consult you just for the fun, you know, just so we can go against what you want."
Clearly, holding the public in total contempt. You know, it's obvious. Everyone's a deplorable. Basically, we know best.
Exactly.
We'll decide.
Exactly
for you.
Right.
Yeah.
We are all deplorables now, Patrick. That's the thing. I think all of the indigenous populations of the former Free West are essentially now reduced to being deplorables. Mm.
Yeah. This is like you said. This is the ultimate beta testing ground. For the European Union. I mean, just in the opening segment, I was explaining, you know, if you're a European Union country, just being by virtue of being a member, you're automatically ceding half of your sovereignty there. And then you lose the other half either by becoming a vassal state to the United States or NATO, basically. And Ireland is even losing its neutral status.
We're not in NATO. We have had a long tradition of neutrality, a very, very kind of, you know, headline neutrality. Like, I mean, we were involved in founding and negotiating and setting up the nuclear anti-proliferation treaty way back in, you know, 50 odd years ago, you know. So, like, we've had a very central role in that, in a very kind of positive, you know, peacemaking role. These guys are tramping all over all that every day, you know, and treating it with total disdain.
Yeah, I know. There's in the weapons defense industry, they want to get into Ireland in a big way. And the out Shannon Airport, there's been a number of, it's been shown that the U.S. use it basically as a way station for military activity in the Middle East and Europe. That's a violation of Irish neutrality. Like literally on the tarmac next to passenger airlines, you'll see C-130s with U.S. troops with guns. By the way, armed as well. So I mean, yeah, it's incredible.
Well, here is an interesting thing, Patrick. That many of the bodies, not all of them, but almost all of who have, would have 20 years ago protested and being the ones to say that are no longer saying it. You know, I'm talking about civil liberties organizations, journalists, you know, poets, writers, artists, painters, you know, those kind of, you know, slightly hippie-ish people that people, you know, that you could always look to have a moral position. They're no longer around. Or if they are, they're saying the direct opposite of what they would have said then. It's quite extraordinary, you know. It renders one speechless, almost. You know, in the face of all this stuff, you know, it's like because there is a broader condition as well, which we haven't time to go into. But like, there is what I call mutism. You know, for many years, nearly ten years now, the people of Ireland, the ordinary people, have been basically silenced on certain issues. They know not to speak publicly about things. So even before this hate speech came around, I mean, this is the final hammer blow. It's not the beginning of something. They've been doing this in all kinds of subtler ways for years and years and years. It's a kind of a national lockjaw, you know, that people, you know, Sharon Senior used to have a line, you know, whatever you say nothing. And that almost could be the epitaph of modern Ireland, of Ireland full stop.
It sounds like this is when I speak to people from Eastern Europe who lived during the Cold War period. That's the sort of things that they tell you.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So here we are, you know, we are in the middle of an Orwell novel that he never got time around to writing, you know, but that's what it is.
Yeah, these are extraordinary times, John, and I'm very, very happy you gave us your time to join us this weekend for this discussion. I think it's an important discussion, and I think it's a discussion we need to keep having as well. And so, again, I want to direct our listeners to John Waters' Substack. Please subscribe and please follow. You get the newsletter and the alerts from John when he's writing or posting an article. You definitely want to keep track of what he's doing with his work, and these issues are so important. And they're not just in Irish. It's not just Irish issues, ladies and gentlemen. This applies to everybody. If you're in Western civilization, you need to get dialed in on this sort of thing right now, because chances are it's happening in your backyard, whether you know it or not. But John Waters, thank you very much for joining us on the Sunday Wire this week.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you. Anytime.
And there he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Again, check out John's Substack. Just click the hyperlink on the main page there on our show page. It'll take you right to his work. Look, let's take a break right now, and we'll go to the other side with our roving correspondent for culture and sport, Basil Valentine. We're going to hit the big headlines, big stories domestically and internationally on the other side. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back.